Good afternoon. My name's Adam Neese. I'm the assistant to the director of programming for Comic-Con International. It's my pleasure to be here today to celebrate the career of our special guest, Shannon Wheeler. Shannon, of course, is known for his work in The New Yorker and The Onion, as well as the creation of the satirical superhero Too Much Coffee Man. His unique brand of humor is featured in his new collection, Memoirs of a Very Stable Genius. On behalf of Comic-Con International and its board of directors, it's my honor to present Shannon with our Ink Pot Award.
It's about 2 minutes long, and it's Scott Bateman did this for me. He's another cartoonist, and I worked with him for a few years. And all the comments in the when it was up on YouTube, all the comments said, "Be sure to read the subtitles." But I mean, that seems really obvious, so I'm not going to say that. All right, get ready, and it should be going. This is from the old days when things used to take forever to load. you. That was the opera, and I'm going to go and start the talk, move back here, and then we hit play, no, and then we hit rehearse slide check, and we are, I'll let you fix it. Any questions? we'll hit that heavy and hard as I go through. I'm going to go through a timeline of sort of chronology of things that I've worked on. And partly because I have just the worst sense of time, so I could say last week and it would seem reasonable to me. But I think it was around 2006, 2007, something like that, and it was just as I was trying to get out of doing too much Coffee Man, and it sort of fell in my lap. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity, and then did a full opera production, which I wasn't really prepared for. All right. Come. I spelled it right, too. That's good. Sometimes. So I'm going to go through my timeline backwards, because I just think it's really boring to start with, oh, here's my baby picture and the first time I read a comic. So I'm going to start with my most recent work and basically what I'm working on now and a little bit of the sort of process of what I'm doing, going through it. And so right now, I'm working on Stormy Daniels. I went to see her recently, which actually could have been 6 months ago, but it was probably last week, and I took my sketchbook, and I was really curious about everybody who was there and all that, and I stood in the back with my sketchbook drawing, and basically, I thought, yeah, this is going to be really cool, I'm going to do this, do these drawings and write this little story about Stormy, and then as I was standing there drawing, I realized that I was the creepy guy in the back with a sketchbook looking at naked ladies. And then at some point, one of the workers, dancers, stripper, one of the workers, I keep trying to not work blue, and then I keep slipping into working blue, so bear with me. So one of the ladies came up to me, and I thought, this is where she busts me and tells me how creepy I was, and that I should stop doing what I was doing. But instead, she gave me a drawing of me. And she said, well, I saw you drawing here, and I thought you were drawing us, so I just came over and wanted to draw you. And here you are on stage getting money. And I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. So that gave me, it emboldened me a little bit, and I thought, all right, I'm gonna go and really throw myself into this. And so I moved up closer, and I put the big red stars over her nipples to keep it family-friendly and decent and tasteful. I moved up close and I started drawing people, and one of the thoughts that I had while I was doing this is that this is kind of a perfect cartoonist's job to be writing a story about Stormy, because a strip club doesn't allow cameras, and so I was able to sit there and draw people and take notes and do that sort of thing in a way that a lot of other, I don't know, reporters or people analyzing this stuff wouldn't be able to do. And then I noticed one guy up front actually had his phone out, and he and his friend were looking at his phone. They were sitting right up front, too. And I was like, what the hell are they doing? So I kind of snuck up behind him and was checking it out. He was showing pictures of his boat to his friend. And they were still putting, you know, they put a dollar up kind of by the stage, and then the stripper actually would pick it up with her butt and just sort of clench it and then dance around with the dollar in her butt, and they're looking at pictures of his boat. And I was like, this is weird. This is on many levels. And then I thought, I've got dollars in my pocket. I hope these aren't butt dollars. This is really, it actually kind of grossed me out. So there was a bunch of other small little things that happened, and at some point, I was basically waiting for Stormy, and there were three types of people there. There were the tourists like myself. There were people that just needed like a tipping point, an excuse to go to strip clubs. And then there were the regulars that were there all the time, and just, it was their living room or something. And so I guess it was there about 3 hours or so before Stormy finally came out, and that was my sketch on that. She moves around quick, so it's actually pretty hard to do. And I watched her and took notes, and it was quite a show. And then after the show, they said, oh, you know, go up and you can get Stormy to sign something and blah, 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 talk to her. And so I did that. And it was, you know, what surprised me about this is that all these people that were there were very sleazy, and the place was sleazy, and the whole thing was sleazy. Stormy was actually super nice and really present and clear eyes. And she said, oh, I saw you sketching. How are your sketches going? And I'm like, eh, they're going sketchy. She's like, I see what you did there. And I was like, wow, that was quick. Like, she was on it, you know? And then so we're chatting because I was trying to get, you know, get some questions asked to her. And I said, yeah, I love your lawyer. And she goes, yeah, he does too. Damn. That was probably rehearsed, but still, it was good. Anyway, recently she's back in the news because she did a performance and I guess touched there's an undercover police officer there, and she touched the officer. And evidently in Ohio, I think, it's against the law for a stripper to touch a client unless they're related. So they put her in jail. And so the story is relevant. So I'm emailing her. She gave me her email. I've been emailing, trying to get these questions, just like questions about Trump and other things that I'm curious about to fill this out. And all this is just one of the stories that I'm working on, and it's partly to pitch to Esquire magazine, because my editor from The New Yorker has moved over to Esquire, so it's kind of given me this in there. And some of the other stories that I've already sent over to him are things like killing a chicken, where I had a chicken that was sick, and then after I found out that the vet wanted to charge $100, I figured I would try to kill it myself, which then I realized was a really difficult thing to do. And so then writing a story about that, sort of all the ins and outs of that. Finally, I figured out that what you should do is just gas it. And so I ran a hose from the car, my van in the front, through my garage into the backyard, put it under a laundry basket, thank you, bucket, and then slowly put her to sleep. She was in a lot of pain, so it was the humane thing to do. But what really shocked me about this, so I'm in my front yard taping a hose that's leading into my garage to the car, and I realized this looks really bad. And then I thought, the police are going to come at any second, right? Like, somebody's going to call the police, and I'm doing this, and it's taking a while because it's kind of hard to lay down and do the thing. And I thought, where are the police? This is kind of sketchy. People are walking by. Hey, how's it going? I'm like, oh, no problem. All's good. You know, but no, it looks sketchy. So that was another story. Did one about selling a love doll that I got. And then another story that I did was story about going to camp with a kid who had a problem. And wow, that's good. Well trained kid. All these stories are in the new book, the Memoirs of a Genius. So that was this year. That book just came out. So going back to last year, 2017, I actually did go and met Trump. Had the privilege of... Okay, that's... Actually, at the Stormy Daniels, one of the people that I ended up talking to was this lady who got a hold of one of the Trump statues that got dropped. I think there were 5 cities altogether. And 3 of the statues got destroyed, a couple by Trump supporters, 1 by police, but... she and her husband managed to get a hold of one of them, and now they rent him out and then donate all the money to the ACLU and other charities and stuff. So if you want to have Trump over for dinner, you can get Trump. And all that kind of relates to the book that I did with My President Says, which was a study in narcissism for Trump. And I took his tweets and illustrated them, which, of course, is all fake news. that's recent. Going back a few more years, I did a lot of projects with other people. I worked with Mark Russell on doing a book called God Is Disappointed in You, where we rewrote the Bible. And Mark did most of the heavy lifting of all the writing. And then I did various cartoons in the book. Some of them more tasteful than others. And then we did a sequel to the Bible together called Apocrypha Now, which has the Gospel of Judas, Infancy of Christ, all these odds and ends, these stories that didn't actually make it into the Bible. Going back further to 2011, I worked with Steve Dean on a book called Oil and Water, which was about the BP oil spill and the deep water horizon. And you can kind of see inside the O, the actual oil rig, and then this is to scale of the drill that went down into the water. So one of the things of doing drawings is trying to get an idea of just the enormity of the location and what happened there and the enormity of the spill. And that was one, again, something that you can do in comics that I feel is kind of particular to the medium. We focused a lot on the people that were there and what they did and who they were. It's a, you know, still some humor in there, but it's a pretty serious book. Before that, or slightly around the same time, I worked on a children's book with Simon Max Hill. Yeah, it starts off tasteless and gets worse. It's rhyming couplets. It's a series of rhyming couplets, and we dressed him up in Nazi clothes, but Grandpa won't wake up. And I tried to stay like restrained and would draw like this is actually my high school biology teacher's clothing that I borrowed to draw. We added fishnet and pantyhose, but Grandpa won't wake up. And this is where I didn't stay all that restrained. And then it gets worse after that. I'm very proud of it. Nowhere in the book does it say for mature readers or indicated at all that it's a parody. And so it winds up in kid. I shouldn't be proud of that. 2008. So this is getting into the New Yorker. And I had just done a book called Screw Heaven, When I Die, I'm Going to Mars. And this was a collection of cartoons, and I was at the Word Stop in Portland, Oregon. And Ben Diddy, who worked at the New Yorker, gave a talk about cartooning and submitting to the New Yorker and whole nine yards. As he was leaving, I walked up and started talking to him about it, and I said, hey, how can I submit to the New Yorker? And he said, well, you just send in 10 cartoons a week. That's the standard. You know, you want to avoid certain. And then he's like, oh, well, I've actually got to make it to the airport. Here, I'll just write down my phone number. Give me a call, and I'll talk to you about it, because I like your stuff, and it sounds great. So this freaked me out so much. I had his phone number, and I had it in my car for about 2 months. Then I moved it inside. I put it over my computer. And every week, I thought, okay, I just need to get submissions set together. I need to do 10 cartoons that are really good, so when I talk to him, I can just send these cartoons straight to him. And every week, I just would struggle with it. I tried drawing cartoons with my left hand, with my right hand. I would get drunk and draw them. I would draw in the morning. I'd draw at night. I would try everything I could to try to get a good set, and I just could not do it. So finally, I thought, this is an old freelancer trick. You wait till Friday afternoon, and you call, because by that time, everybody's left the office, so you leave a message, and that gives you 2 days of Saturday and Sunday to do all your work. And then Monday, they call you back, and they say, oh, got your message. Oh, yeah, sorry to have missed you. And then you have all your work done, and that way you give yourself it. And I thought, okay, if I give myself this pressure, then I'll have something together by the time he calls back. But he answered the phone, which blew my plan, and it had been 9 months. So he said, who's this? I said, oh, this is Shannon Wheeler. We met. You gave me your phone number. He's like, I didn't what? And I said, yeah, about cartooning. You said they give you a call. And he's like, I was recently, and I met you in Portland. He's like, who are you? And he sounded really pissed off at this point. So I finally came clean. I said, look, I've had your phone number for 9 months. I've been stressing out over it every day. I really, like, my whole game plan was shot, so I just, like, came clean. And he's like, oh, okay. What do you want? I said, how do I get in? How do I say, okay, send in 10 cartoons. So I just sat down. I did 10 cartoons. I sent them to him. And he said, well, these are pretty good. Either I can critique you and, you know, send me cartoons and I'm happy to critique you and we could work on your cartoons, or I could just bring them up to Bob now. And I saw that this is an opportunity to really learn the inner workings of a scene. And so I thought, yeah, this is, I want to do that. I should take advantage of this opportunity because it's a genuine opportunity. So I said, yeah, critique me. And so I'd send Matt every week 10 cartoons. And he would just tell me how terrible they were. And every week, you know, it's like, this one is not drawn well. This isn't funny. The timing, there's too many words in this. This is a pun, and the New Yorker doesn't like puns. This is about homeless people. We don't do homeless people cartoons anymore. Fat is off the table. Anything. It just, the list of what not to do was intense. And I would go through all these changes in my head of, like, you know, anger and denial bargaining, thinking, hey, I've read your cartoons. They're not that good. Like, I've cartooned for The Onion. I've done this other stuff. Like, I had this ego, and I just had to let go of all that and decide, like, am I going to trust this guy's advice and learn how to do this, or am I going to have this arrogance and fight him on stuff? And I thought, I need to let go of what I know and relearn how to cartoon. And so it was a real process of about 6 months, 8 months, maybe even. And finally, he said, yeah, let's get your 10 best. I'll take them up to Bob. He did that. Bob said, yeah, these are great. Tell him he can start faxing them in now. So I had to buy a fax machine. And then I started faxing my cartoons. And every week, I'm faxing 10 cartoons. And so I went from getting this intense criticism to getting nothing. It was just every week. There's no rejection letter because I was at the tier of faxing, so there's just nothing. And every week, and I just thought, did I get the right phone number? I didn't want to call and ask. Is this for real? Maybe Bob and Matt are kind of conspiring just to jerk my chain and make fun of me and make me feel horrible about myself. I honestly didn't know. And finally, like, it was just another, I thought I made it through the marathon. And then it was just another marathon. And so finally, after 8 months, I have no idea. After a long time, I finally got a cartoon in the New Yorker. And it didn't run in this issue. So the day after I sold this cartoon to the New Yorker, I'm walking down the street and I see two friends of mine. There's Kieran Dwyer, who's another comic book artist, and Rick Remender, and we start talking, you know, and I want to bury the lead on this one, so I'm waiting to tell them, blah, 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 but, you know, oh, what are you up to? I was like, I just sold my first cartoon to the New Yorker, and without missing a beat, Rick goes, oh, is it two cats talking? And then Kieran goes, yeah, saying something pithy, and then Rick goes, yeah, something that's kind of funny now, but won't be funny in 5 years, and it just went on and on. I was like, God damn it. It's good to have friends. Keep you in your place. So I kept submitting stuff to the New Yorker, and I have sold, you know, a few cartoons there. It's been really nice. It has been a real education. And you get to go down there and see people and talk to other cartoonists. Everybody's genuinely good people there. It's really nice. So this is one that sold recently. I think it, I hope it ran. I think it ran. I liked it because it had the... It ran. Okay, good. My Batman card. This is me pandering to this audience. Nice Sisyphus cartoon. I like my wine cartoon. And I kept working on wine cartoons because I knew if I sold a wine cartoon, they'll license your cartoon. So you sell it to them and then they keep selling it. So you make money off of it for a good 5-6 years afterwards. And sure enough, while I was Googling this, because I didn't have, I don't know, where I had to I pulled this image off the internet. I came across this. And I said, "Oh, right, that was probably $300-$400 for me, just getting for nothing." It's great. Ah, it's low res, but still, I'm gonna get some of those coasters, which will be $20 out of my $300 or whatever they pay. So a little bit on my process. People said, "Well, where do you get your ideas and all that?" And pretty much, it's I'll be writing on the Max, which is our light rail, and I'll think. Yes. I'll say, "Hey, here's an idea," and I write it down, and then I take a photo of it because I know that if I don't take it, I'll wash my hands and then I'll lose the idea. I've lost 3 or 4 ideas that I'm still, like, that probably would have sold. So, but anywhere, any place, anytime, I'm always writing down whatever dumb idea, and some of them sell, some of them. This one says, "Okay, now I have a question for you," which is the guy Conor McGregor had asking, you know, I guess now it's the wise man asking the guy Conor McGregor had, which I like, because it sets, one of the things I've noticed about New Yorker cartoons and one of the little gimmicks of them is that they create a narrative. So there's a single panel cartoon, but reading a cartoon like this, it creates a story that anticipates this moment and then also creates your head also fills in what happens after this cartoon. And so, in a way, it's a full narrative, and that's something really unique. And when I started, kind of came across that idea, I started reading other New Yorker cartoons, and sure enough, like every one of them, or most of them, had that, which I thought was kind of, I just liked it. Okay, so here we are, the opera. This is 2006. What did I say? 2007? 2007? I don't know. So 2006, I looked this up on the internet too. This was the time when I was actually doing really well. I was really happy. I had a cartoon. It hadn't run yet, but The Onion, I was in talks with them. They were wanting to run my stuff. I was wanting to do it, just figuring out things about it. And I liked the editor. They liked me. It was all that was great. I was dating a ballerina, which was pretty, that's actually her. I was pretty stoked about that. And my opera was in production. Like, they were working on it for a place in Texas. They were going to run it in a coffee shop or like a small venue. It was great. Then The Onion came back to me and said, "Well, we want to run your stuff, but we just can't do it yet. We don't know when. We're working out space." The place in Texas burned down. And this is all in the same week. And the ballerina broke up with me. So, I was sad, and I was sad for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months or something like that. So finally, I wasn't going out, I wasn't doing anything, and finally a friend of mine, Paul Guinan, said, "Oh, I've got an art show, come out, come out to my art show." I was like, alright, I'll get myself to go out. So I went, and as I got there, I realized that his art show was actually where the ballet performs. So I did what any rational person does and just drink as much free wine as I could. And when I was 3 or 4 glasses in, I met a woman there, and I, you know, we were chatting, and I said, "Hey, what do you do?" And she said, "Oh, I'm the managing operator of this place, and I decide what plays and sort of who plays when and how and blah, 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 and all that." And she said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I just wrote an opera." And then I just pitched the opera. I said, "Oh, that sounds really nice." And then the next morning, I woke up and I really, like, what have I done? And she said, so I thought, okay, either I hide my head in shame and just give up this whole thing, or I follow through with it and I call her up and say, "Hey, I did write this opera. I really want to do it." So that's what I did. And she said, "Oh, that sounds really great." She's very nice, very polite. "Send over the music." So, send over, that's not the music, but I sent her the music score, and she goes, "Oh, that's really great. What are the words?" So I sent her the libretto, which are the words. This is a love song. This is a love opening love song where he sings a love song to love. She's like, "Oh, that's cool. You know, I really wish I could see it." So then I started doing all these drawings of it, and I said, So every week, what I did is I would send her a new package of stuff, and I tried to make sure it had at least 8 pages of stuff in it, so it looked like I was doing something. So every week, I was like pounding away on this. I actually snuck into the hall where it was going to be performed and measured it out to just sort of see sort of what it was like. And while I was in there, I saw a model of an opera or a play that had been performed. I thought, oh, that's cool. I wish I knew somebody that could make a model. Oh, I can do that. 5 years of architecture school. So I made a model and took a bunch of pictures of that and that, like, moved the little things around. The little people for the different acts, and I would, like, act out the whole thing and take pictures and all that. And so every week, that was my show. And she said, oh, I'd love to hear it. So that's when I hired musicians. I had them come in, record a set of songs for send her a CD. It was just relentless. I was sure every Monday she'd get a package. And this is just because I was depressed. And I was like, I'm going to do this thing. So she said, yeah, let's do it. Let's do the opera. And we got a costume designer, got a producer, and actually produced a two-minute comedy opera, which went pretty well for the most part. Like doing it was really hard because I honestly did not know what I was doing at all. The music was done by a guy named Daniel Crafts. I worked with Damien Wilcox and Loretto, and I've never done stage production. But I thought, oh yeah, this would be easy, you just kind of do it. And I guess that's not really the case. So opening night, I'm sitting in the back of the hall, and I'd hustled it, and we'd sold out that 200-seat hall, and I'm sitting in the back end, and I'm waiting for it to begin, and the music sort of starts, and there's a little prelude, and I realize this could be the worst night of my life. And I'm just waiting. And did anybody do the high dive when they were a kid? And then the first time, and you're like a bunch of you down at the bottom, and there's the kids that go up, and they're really scared. They look really scared, and you're all laughing at them. And then the girl goes up, and she's really scared, and you're laughing at her, and then she jumps, and then the little kid with glasses goes up, and then finally it's your turn, and you're like, oh yeah, and you're about halfway up. And all of a sudden, you're just filled with fear because you realize that you could die. And this is really dangerous. There's no seatbelt. There's no, you're holding on. And you get that extra sensory perception where, like, the cold water that's pooled on the little rungs and the little drippy teeth of the rungs. And you're just going up slowly. And then you get to the very top. And you're like, now I need to jump off. And you realize you can't go back down because you've made fun of everybody else for the last 20 minutes watching them go off. And so now you have to do, that's what it felt like as I was waiting for the opera to start. I thought, I have made the biggest mistake in my life and this is horrible. Then it hit, there's the opera thing, it caught and people started laughing. I was like, ah, thank God, it's okay. And it's weird too because it's not like Rossini where we changed the words. Like this was, we wrote a whole opera. It's short. I wanted it short just in case it sucked, but it's a real opera. It's great. We added the show, sold out, and since then it's produced in Albuquerque. We've done it in Seattle. We've done it in Berkeley a few times. Well, we did it in San Diego a couple times too. So it's oddly one of the more successful independent gonzo opera things. And it's the first opera based on a comic book, which I think is kind of cool. We've had, I think, one or two since then, but still, that was cool. So, going back to 2001, check my notes to make sure I get this right. Did a magazine called Too Much Coffee Man. And that was fun. I worked with a bunch of other cartoonists, other writers. And that was our editor that's on enough, who's actually Paul's wife, who had the art show later in the timeline, earlier in this slideshow.
She's the Eisner presenter.
Oh, yeah, she's presenting Eisner's now, too, which is cool. Oh, and I forgot, too, to put in here that I'm up for an Eisner as well this year. Too Much Gotham Man, I blazed through to the end. The questions are my favorite part. So Too Much Gotham Man is a comic book that I did 93 to 2001, plus or minus. I did mini comics and then moved into a full comic book. And I did, these are the 9 issues, and I did them black and white, so I alternate. The top left is number 1, and the number 2 is the white one, Monsters, kind of homage, the origin issues, number 3. So I thought if ever a store did a large display, they could do it as a nice checkerboard black and white pattern. And it's, I'm a big fan of ska, so I was like, yeah, black and white checkerboard. I would do strips for newspapers and steal photo-mobilizers as much as I could. And Too Much Gotham Man number 1. So this moving backwards to the first issue. This is what I think I haven't ever talked about, or sober publicly anyways. I knew doing Too Much Gotham Man number 1 that would be a hard sell. And everybody was telling me not to do this comic book because they were saying this is the worst time ever. Up to that point, more new comics were being released that year than any other ever. So I thought, I need to do something that's going to help sell this book. So what I did was say, they used to have things called incentives where you make 10 of something. If a store buys 10, they get like an extra piece of plastic something, bullshit thing. So I thought, I can't, you know, I don't want to pay for that. So what could I do that's cheap and easy and still do the job of getting comics to sell? So I said, if you buy 10 of these comics, you get a free animation cell. Which is a little bit tricky because there's no animation. But it implied that there was. And it implied that they need to get in on this the same way the turtles exploded. This is going to follow suit. So they need to buy 10 now because they didn't buy 10 turtles. Because I know how that works with their mind. So I was like, this is going to be great. Except that it sold 10,000 books and I had to do 1,027 sales. So I brought my friends over and I would do the line work and then I'd hand it to the flesh guy and he'd paint in the flesh, hand it to the white guy, he'd paint in the white, hand it to the red guy. So we had a round robin, I'd buy pizza and beer, we'd sit around. It took us about 12 hours of just banging away on it. And I tried to do the drawings, so I'd tell little stories by doing drawings. And then I'd put random numbers, like I'd say 27C at the top right, just so it sort of looked like, and it was completely random with it. And the weird thing was, it's short, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 issues after that, I actually got a call from Converse Tennessee, where this guy, Harry, at the Houston ad agency, and they wanted to do a animated cartoon. So we ended up doing, there actually was an animation that came out, like, within the year. So it was this weird kind of convergence. It was, which of course, it has nothing to do with the sales that I did, but everybody conflates them. It's great. So yeah, you know that secret now. And the other one is, I wanted to do t-shirts, and I really wanted to do a good t-shirt. I thought, what makes a good t-shirt? Kanji. Kanji looks good. You can do a terrible drawing, but like this Japanese writing, you put that next to it. It's like putting the New Yorker above something. You have something terrible, put New Yorker on it, it's like all of a sudden great. And that's the same thing with kanji. You put this, you know, I guess 2,500 years of evolution of graphic design, and you're going to get something that looks sweet. And you seal that and use it yourself, and it looks good. So I was like, okay, how can I do this legitimately? Well, if I was selling Too Much Gotham in Japan, I could do this and really use this. And I thought, well, I don't know how to get this distributed there. Don't know how to do this. So then I was like, well, okay, what if it was bootlegged in Japan? She's like, okay, how do I set up a bootleg? Like, how do I get this image there and have somebody do it and not get paid for it so it's bootlegged? And then I thought, why go through all that trouble? I'll just say it was bootlegged. And then bootleg the bootleg and just produce the shirts as though it was a bootleg, as though I didn't do the art. I was like, that's perfect. It's funny. So that's what I did. Is I did artwork that looked slightly like mine, but a little bit off. And I was like, yeah, that worked. So anyway, I had my friend Sam Hurd, his mom, grew up. So she did the kanji, and she wrote out a whole thing about what each piece means, with coffee, coffee, and the letters and all that stuff. And I had a hard time reading her handwriting, but it evidently explains what it all means. Everybody asks me that. It means often, person who drinks coffee often. But I like the shirt though, it's been really good. Except I can't take credit for the art, which is always kind of pissed me off. So going back further, Jab, and this is a comic book that my friends and I did. We started off with four of us, and we all wanted to get together and do comics, and each of us kind of had a different ability. And our idea was each of us would contribute to a small company, we'd each do what we're good at, and then we all wanted to do comics, and we'd publish all of our comics. It would be kind of like a Image Comics, except, you know, four guys in Texas, except really stupid people. And so we put out our first Jab comic book, and it sold okay. And then the second issue just did not sell. It sold about half, which is normal, but we thought we would break the mold and sell more. So we thought, third issue, let's shoot it. And so that's what that is. This book has a bullet hole in it. It's not meant. Dear God in heaven, it's not meant. And if you look close, you can see the bullet hole there. And as the bullet would go through the comic, we actually tried to integrate the stories on every page. Most of us did this where we had, like, I had the Elvis Decanter. Originally, I was going to have JFK, but I thought that was probably pushing a little too far. But an Elvis Decanter is still pretty good. But I accepted gifts and lobbyists. I lied to press, raised the tax, I sold arms to Iraq, manipulated SNL funds. But it couldn't be any of that stuff because nobody's ever convicted for doing any of those things ever. And too much coffee, man gets shot with a gun in some way. His mug breaks, and then he's sitting in jail with a broken mug. And then people say, oh, that's really great how you punched that hole in the comic book. It's like, no, we actually, you know, we shot that guy. And so, you know, and first day we had like 15 of us out there with guns and shooting comics. And then the next day there was three of us. And then I shot the remaining 3,000 comic books myself, alone in a friend's house in the garage. And I was like, I don't, you know, can I do this in your garage? And he's like, yeah, it's a 22. It's not a big deal. Just turn up the music. It's fine. It's like, all right. So, yeah, I shot 3,000 comics in the garage. All right, I'm going to place two so we can get questions. So before that, 1989, Children of Blue. This is what got me doing Too Much Coffee, Man. This is the first book. I was cartooning at the Daily California, and then I moved to Texas, where I was pretending to go to college, so the college paper would run my comics in the Daily Texan. And then I collected them in Children of Blue, so it was cartoons like, look, man, here's one of my funnier ones. Cartoon is showing off their work, so it's, this is not going to be in newspapers. This is another joke I have to explain. So I did mini comics with Too Much Coffee Man as a way to sell the book. And my idea is people would spend 25 cents on a mini comic, like it, come back and buy the book for $5. But instead people came back and said, oh, we want more Too Much Coffee Man. So that's how I said, well, you know, why fight the tide? I'll just do more Too Much Coffee Man. And to make it interesting for myself, I had things like Too Much Coffee Man fighting Trademark Copyright Man, and they'd have a legal battle. It's TMCM versus TMCM.
What is that?
That's TMCM. Trademark Copyright Man. I guess it's 93, because I put it on the stuff when I said copyright. TM, Trademark Copyright, 1993. And very much how I feel about comics. So many comic books, why bother making another? Another pebble on the beach, another drop in the ocean, there's no point, no hope. That was, and then he sees the kids reading his comic and he gets kind of happy about it, so he decides to do more. And in the cliche, each issue had a theme, and this one I was particularly proud of, where it's the writer's block. So the first gag there is the cartoonist struggling with a blank page, having writer's block. And then you get the literal gag of the block in his head, which is a visualization of the writer's block. And then that slowly twists and turns to fill the panel with a blank panel. So it becomes another pun of not of being a white blank panel of lacking, I guess. And then the block actually becomes a panel where it's actually blocking and stopping the story, so the writer's block actually stops the story. And I feel compelled to explain this because it's like everybody does their writer, like, I don't have an idea comic, and it's really stupid, but you know, I thought, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it with late, like, I, so, anyway. So, you know, doing these things, like, I wanted to do comics that were interesting to me, and that's what brings us back to Stormy Daniels. I have a guilty look on my face. And I want to take questions, so, Booth K13 Small Press, and I did a painting for you guys, too, last week, so this is a painting that is about 8 feet tall. Hard to miss. All right, so let's do some Q&A. Yeah?
What was
your
Spokane
I did a Too Much Crack Man because the police in the bullet hole issue that were going after Too Much Coffee Man were actually looking for Too Much Crack Man, but they just stormed the wrong house, which is, now it would be ICE, but back then we didn't have ICE. Arresting the wrong people. but yes. No, Too Much Crack Man did not become Too Much Crack Man. Crack is bad.
Why is Too Much Crack Man bad?
Because you lose your teeth, you lose your friends, you spend all your money on crack, and then you lose your house, and it's bad. Drugs are bad. Yeah. I do, and I just grin and like, you know, the thing with it was a lie and it was deceptive. It wasn't a lie because I never said this is a cartoon. I said animation sell. So I was very careful. I don't know why, but everybody in comics lies, so that I was very careful not to actually lie. But yeah, I was totally full of shit with it. I do see them. They're up on the walls. And that was the other thing, because I knew that they would get that sell and it would be a perpetual advertisement, better than a poster would. And then there would be a conversation. Oh, let me tell you about this. You know, blah, blah, blah. So it would act, it did what it was supposed to do, like sell the comic and sell it over a long period of time. But, you know, on the other hand, it was actually, I did over 1,000 hand-drawn and then my friends hand-painted them. Like, these are individual drawings for people. So it actually is worth more than an animation cell in most ways. Yeah?
When you put up the magazine cover for Too Much Coffee Man, there was a blurb there that said, sued by Starbucks. Is that for real?
Yes. The question is, there's a blurb that says, sued by Starbucks. It's actually Karen Dwyer, the one who made fun of me for the New Yorker cartoon. He did cartoons about Starbucks called Consumer Whore, where he took the Starbucks logo and modified it to look like a love doll. Oh, there's a lot of callbacks on this. And they came after and sued him. But oddly enough, it wasn't for the comics, because that's protected under free speech. But he also did some rulers and something else. The merchandising of it, they busted him on. And they didn't do a cease and desist. They came after him and sued him. And he wrote a long piece about that experience. Oh, yeah.
Is it possible you might have a third book coming out and he got disappointed you and never talked about it?
I'm bugging Mark, and he's talked about doing a new Bible. Are we going to have a third Bible? Yes. I've been bugging Mark to do a children's Bible, but he's really resistant to that. But he has talked about doing, I'm going to speak for him here, doing a Bible or about religion being a function of man and the evolution of religion over time and how different religions have suited the purposes and needs of man and mankind, I guess I should say, as we manifest destiny of Mormonism. And each time there's an evolution or a change in religion, it's because of the change in the need of what people are needing at that time. And I hope he does. I'm in for it. Each of these, like, I wanted to do the Bible book in part, the first one, because I really wanted to learn
about the Bible. I think it's a really important book, and it was about the only way to get me to read that boring thing. So they paid for it. So. Another question? Do we have, how's our time? Got any more questions? We got time, huh? No, we're starting to feel like 5 minutes? Oh, it's good for at least half a question. Fire away, who's got a question? Yes?
In one of the slides, there was a page of Gumby and Pokey. Gumby and
Pokey Comics? Yeah, I'm part of the elite club that got ripped off by the Mel, who published Gumby for a short period of time. And I did a free comic with a Gumby story. And Rick Geary drew some of it, and Mark O'Day drew some of it, and I wrote it and drew some of it myself. I think I have a page. I was pulling out art left and right to sell, so I think I got that page to sell down at the table. Yeah, it was really neat, especially to work with Rick Geary, who I've been a fan of for years. But it was, and writing Gumby too. I hadn't, because he could jump into books, so I had him jumping into paintings. I had the blockhead steal a painting, and then Gumby would jump in and do, like, it was an excuse to do, like, Gumby walking down a staircase to do shock, you know, do descending staircase. And he goes in the blue painting with the guitarist and singing some, I don't know, like, Journey song or something. So, another question? No. Oh, yeah. Yes. There is irony in that. Doing a Trump, a book about Trump, and actually what I realized when I was about halfway into it is that not only is he a collaborator, he's actually the writer of the book. And I thought, man, if I got to write him a royalty check and send him, if he cashed it, that would be great. That would be funny as hell. But yeah, it is a little bit distasteful. But I've done worse things, so. Another question? A burning question? Thea? Question? No? Well, shoot. I think that is, I think, pretty solid on time. I think that's just about it. Thank you guys so much for coming. I'm telling you, very, very, very cool. And, yeah. Oh, shoot, yeah, I am up for an Eisner, too. I forgot that. And that's tomorrow night. And that's the Marley's Ghost book that I worked on. And that's Dickens. So I went from Trump to Dickens as a collaborator. And I'm part of the team. And the, again, another theme that I like that is that one of the secrets that I've always had is always work with people smarter than yourself. Which is true for relationships, too, actually. So thank you, guys. Yeah. Oh, we do have a question. Yes, Thea.
What happens if a bad guy comes and cuts the paper in half?
What happens if a bad guy comes and cuts the paper in half? In the Gumby story, where you, in the painting, that's a good question. Even if Gumby gets cut in half, which I've seen happen, he reforms himself. I was a Gumby fan my whole life. Like every year I would go to the Gumby Festival in Berkeley, at the UC Theater, and that's where I learned what pot smelled like. I would see, and Clokey would come, or Clokey would come and talk to the audience, and I'd, you know, people would yell out things that were really dirty, and I don't know, he took it in good humor. It was funny to see. But somebody asked, like, what drugs inspired you to do Gumby? And he goes, and they're like, did you do a lot of acid? And he's like, No, never did acid. I really don't smoke pot, and but nitrous oxide, I'm a very, very big fan of. That was good. All right. Well, I think I've violated about every norm. I'm not sure if I missed something, but thanks again, everybody, and I hope to see you.